Good evening and welcome to City Vision, celebrating its 20th year on KALW. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Tonight, we're going to ask, what images come to mind when you think of public art? Is it monuments, memorials, grand sculptures? Well, public art is changing, according to our guests, and tonight we're going to find out how, as we talk to an art historian, a public art funder, and a nonprofit agency executive director. So tonight we welcome Jackie Francis, an art historian and senior lecturer in the program in visual and critical studies at the Department of Painting and Drawing at the California College of the Arts and co-editor of an anthology about Romain Bearden entitled Romain Bearden, American Modernist. I'll get that answer. I'll get that name better the next time we talk about it. Welcome, Jackie. And we're also joined tonight by Courtney Fink. She's executive director of Southern Exposure. And Southern Exposure is a nonprofit agency that helps artists to realize their ideas of public art and works to bring public art to the Bay Area. Welcome, Courtney.
Thank you.
And we're also joined by Susan Pontius, and she's program director for the Public Art Program and Civic Art Collection for the San Francisco Art Commission and the Department of the City and County of San Francisco. And there she directs the implementation of the city's Percent for Art program, which generates approximately $3 million annually from a 2% allocation of the construction costs of city capital improvements. And she also oversees the stewardship of over 4,000 art objects in the city and county's collection. She's been there since 1990. Welcome, Susan.
Thank you.
And we welcome you, our listeners, to join our conversation tonight. You can dial 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. We'll open the phone lines in about 20 minutes. Or you can email us now at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. So, Jackie Francis, I wanted to start with you. Tell us, what do people mean when they say public art?
Well, Joseph, it's exactly as your lead-in suggested. It's what we think about in terms of monuments, sculptural, things that are non-figurative, things like obelisks, murals, etc. And we think about them as public because most of them can see us, see them. They're not in private collections. They're not behind locked doors. They are for as many people as possible to see. So even things that are in public churches in some ways, although the church is a private commissioner, when there are groups of people who go into churches, those things are public art as well. And that's the case whether it's a church or a temple or a synagogue, etc. But I think largely with this idea of public art, we're thinking about things that are murals in our city spaces, our city buildings. There are murals that are open to the public in terms of corporate building lobbies, etc. So the public means as many people as possible, almost an uncountable public that crosses any number of different communities, demographics, etc.
So what it sounds like is that public art is really about the accessibility.
Absolutely. I mean, the way we can define public art is perhaps through the negation that it's not private, that it's not clandestine, that it's not locked off. It's not in a private mansion. It is not in a private building, but it's for as many people as possible to see, enjoy, be affected by.
And this concept of public art, is it a relatively new one, or is it something that has been in existence for quite some time?
Well, you know, thinking about it in preparation for the show, I mean, that's why I started thinking about religious art or ritual art, etc. I mean, there might be something that's a religious procession. In some ways, that's a public art performance that goes back many millennia, but we don't necessarily think about that. We might think about, in terms of the religious context, perhaps something, you know, in Europe, public art in the Vatican. Again, it's religious art commissioned by an authority, the Roman Catholic Church, but that is for the public to see. In North America and in Europe, we can think about government public art. I mean, Washington, D.C., of course, with the Lincoln Monument, with the Washington Monument, etc. These are centuries-old projects and buildings and important monuments.
And what is the purpose of public art? I mean, you've talked a little bit about how bringing it to the public, but what is the message that, or the place that public art fills in society?
Well, public art is obviously supposed to memorialize in many cases, in terms of leaders of a nation, of a republic, you know, so we have many monuments to Washington throughout the city today. Earlier today, I was up in North Beach, so I saw our Columbus Monument right by Coit Tower. There are monuments like that that are certainly for fallen soldiers in terms of wars, et cetera. And those are long centuries old traditions in many countries in North America and in Europe.
Hmm. And it sounds like when you evoke those kinds of images of these grand pieces that, you know, anyone within earshot of this program can say, oh, I know that. I know the Lincoln Memorial. I know Coit Tower. I know the Statue of Columbus. It sounds like it's a way of bringing people together, of linking people, not just a sort of a unidirectional kind of, this is a piece and it speaks to one person, but it's speaking to a collective.
Yes, absolutely. I think it's also, you know, we think about them as memorials, but also they're supposed to edify. They're supposed to inspire. You're supposed to look at their grandiosity, maybe because they're taller than you are, they're grander in scale, they're made of bronze, so they seem massive and significant. And they're supposed to affect you in that way. And I mean, affect not only in a physical sense, but in an emotional sense. And it's supposed to affect as many people as possible. And these are the things that kind of bring people together as a city collective or a national collective, that this is something that we look at and identify as San Franciscans or Bay Area residents or Americans and so forth.
So ways that people kind of define who they are.
Exactly.
As a people, as a grouping. And how is that shifting? I mean, that's the premise of tonight's show, is that, in fact, public art is still, in many ways, the monuments, the murals. But how is it shifting over time?
I think as somebody who's thinking as an art historian and certainly looking at contemporary art, it seems to me that even as we continue to do things that are murals, even as we do things that are sculptural, some of them very playful, like the Cupid's bow sculpture down in the Embarcadero, we also have this desire to really involve the public in public art. That is to say that it's not what some have described as a passive appreciation of a sculpture or a passive appreciation of a mural, but instead some sort of social relationship between an artist who is a maker and a public that's there inspiring the artist, informing the artist on what the project should be, what it should look like. We don't even have to think only in terms of the visual. We can think about projects that are performative, that involve sound, that involve perhaps taste, if an artist is making food for a community, that involve other senses, etc. And so the public, to me, in terms of public art, has become more and more important. It seems more palpable than ever.
So it sounds like it's really exploding the notion of what public art is to include other types of media and other types of experience.
Absolutely.
But that experience ultimately is the final piece of where we are now.
Absolutely. And again, I don't think that murals and public sculpture are going anywhere. But broadening the idea, expanding the idea of what public art is, seems to me to be also expanding the idea of what the public artist is. And perhaps Susan and Courtney, I think, will say a lot about that in terms of their relationships with artists.
Yeah, and before I turn to them, I wanted to stay with you for one more question, just to kind of lay it out, and perhaps we'll delve into it a little bit more. Why this shift?
Well, I think because of certain kinds of questions about what art is in the late 20th century and into the early 21st century, certain sorts of questions and maybe some might say attacks on notions of art that are some see as elite or off-putting, that perhaps artists and their publics are demanding a more interactive, a more leveling, a more social art practice and art making aesthetic, something that's not just about a kind of making process that's centuries old, but something that seems to be more engaging for some people. And of course, audiences differ. Many people are still engaged by paintings. I certainly am. They're not going anywhere. But other people want things that seem to speak to their individual experience or their communities.
And that was Jackie Francis. She's art historian and senior lecturer in the program in visual and critical studies and the Department of Painting and Drawing at the California College of the Arts and co-editor of an anthology about Ramar Bearden entitled Ramar Bearden, American Modernist. And we're going to turn next to Susan Pontius. She is program director for the Public Art Program and Civic Art Collection for the San Francisco Arts Commission. And you've been there since 1990, is that correct?
That's correct.
So, can you say a little bit more about this shift that Jackie's been talking about?
Well, I would certainly agree with Jackie that the realm of what is public art and what artists have been engaged in has certainly broadened from the days of the Grand Monument. We have artists now who are engaged in all kinds of artworks that are involved with the public. The big change that I see that happened in the mid-80s was this deeper involvement with the artist with the site that where the artwork was going to be commissioned. I think with the early days of public art, the idea was that you would put contemporary sculpture out on a site and people would just appreciate it because it was there. And that didn't turn out to be the case. And so, because it often wasn't thought about, you know, really how it related to its site, how it related to its public, how the public became engaged in the art. And then the artists themselves really wanted a deeper and more profound engagement with the site. And so artists began getting involved in these projects, usually capital projects, which was bringing about the funding, which is what it is in San Francisco, and being engaged in the early stages of design of a building or a site, where they start being able to be involved in those very critical decisions about the design of the entire site that really broadened their involvement.
So I'm wondering, as I'm listening to this, is this as much about the art and where the art goes as much as it might be a conversation of how we conceive of space and public space and the meaning and the function of public space?
Well, I'm not sure I understood that question.
Well, I guess what I'm getting at is public art shifting because it's about trying to change the actual forms and what is represented, or is it a dialogue or a conversation about how public space is used and the concept of space?
Oh, I certainly think the latter. I think that that the forms of public art are changing, are broadening. I would say ever broadening, because it's artists are always pushing the envelope about what they can do, how they can engage in the space, what the conversation is between their practice and the site in which they're working. And we as as an agency or as a funder, when we look at a new project, say a hospital, I've just finished working on Laguna Honda Hospital Rehabilitation Center, the first thing I look at is, well, what is the goal of the facility? What is it trying to do here? And how is art a part of that? How can the artist make meaningful work in this facility and really help them realize what it is they're trying to do? So, for instance, at Laguna Honda, where we know that that wayfinding is a huge issue. We know a lot of our residents there are sight impaired. We know that it's a residential facility. It's an institution. It's very important that the site be sort of humanized and personalized. Well, these are roles that art is tailor made to make. So that's how we would involve an artist there, and that's how artists look to be involved.
So it's sort of intimately woven with the purpose
and
the function of the site.
It's intimately woven with the purpose of the site, exactly.
And so it also sounds like it's not just about bringing art into the light and bringing out art into fresh air. It's really about how the dialogue between the space and the art.
Yes, for instance, one of our artists out there, for instance, noticed that a lot of the residents, many of who use wheelchairs, their focus was on pulling themselves along with the handrail, and that's really where they were looking. So he decided that he would make a sculptural handrail, so that tactile experience of moving along the handrail and this kind of sculpture, which was where they could really, really experience it, became his artwork.
And going back to you, Jackie, for just a moment, is what's different about art that's made for a gallery or art that's made for private consumption and art that is in many ways functional, like the way that Susan is describing, or art that has a very explicit purpose almost?
Well, I think that certainly some would say that art for a gallery or art for a museum is art for art's sake. I mean, that's a, you know, again, centuries-old discussion that we could do many programs on.
And
we should bring us all back. But I think what Susan is saying is that in public spaces, oftentimes, you want art to really to inspire people and speak to their experiences. And certainly, we have examples of that, not just in terms of sculptural guardrails, but when perhaps the color of a space changes as you move from 10 meters to 10 meters beyond that to 10 meters beyond that. It helps you understand that you're moving through space, that you're a body, and that the space is changing, and it helps you understand, oh, for instance, oh, I'm getting closer to another office, etc. So that's the sort of functionality that art in a public space, in a public site, can do for, in a very subtle way, to help people enjoy the space, feel less anxious about it, etc.
And I want to introduce Courtney Fink. She's Executive Director of Southern Exposure, a nonprofit visual arts organization based here in San Francisco that supports artists in the development and presentation of new works and ideas. It's been around for 37 years and has been engaging the public in artists' works and has evolved in response to the needs of artists and their communities. So welcome, Courtney.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
So although not an artist yourself, you work very intimately with artists on public art. And I'm curious, as you have heard Jackie and then Susan talk, what has driven artists towards getting out into the public and really wanting to reach out and interact with their audience?
Right. Well, you know, it's funny because I feel like that type of engaged practice maybe that we're talking about right now, it exists both within sort of a gallery context and within an alternative space context for sure, as much maybe as it does outside of a gallery context.
So it's not an either or.
It's not really an either or for me. And, you know, Southern Exposure is, I would say, an artist-centered organization. So really it's our job to respond to artist practices. And, you know, I would say, you know, for the last 30, 40 years, this sort of more engaged shift in public art, you know, has been at the forefront. I almost feel like the contemporary and, you know, from the 60s on, conceptual contemporary art practices, I feel like public art just reflects those practices, however, in public space. For me, it more has to do with artists wanting to, you know, art has an important role to play within society, within our daily life, and I feel like as artists have moved their work beyond the confines, I say confines because it can be very limiting, of the gallery, it enables their work to, you know, activate public space, enter more into a dialogue with a general public. I would say sometimes an art audience can be very limiting if you're doing an engaged project, a political project, something that's reflective of something that's going on in the world where you feel like you need to reach more people. And, you know, Southern Exposure's role is to follow the desires of artists and to really follow them to the place where they want to work and really help them realize, like, a dream project. So I have a very different role to play, I would say, in the trajectory of public art. We're also fairly small. We're independent. We can be more vanguard, more adventurous, more daring, and sort of maybe put ideas out there that aren't accepted all the time. And so, you know, it's a small voice in a larger dialogue, but it's a very important one.
In case you're just joining us, this is City Visions on 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at kalw.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're talking about the changing concept of public art with our guest Jackie Francis of the California College of Arts, Courtney Fink, Executive Director of Southern Exposure, and Susan Pontius of the Public Art Program and Civic Art Collection for the San Francisco Arts Commission. And we welcome you, our listeners, to join our conversation. The number to dial is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. What do you think of public art? Are you a consumer? Are you a maker? What is the role of public art in your life? 415-841-4134, or you can email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. So to stay with you, Courtney, I want to push this a little harder. What is it that's getting artists yearning to engage the public more? Was there a sense at some point that there was disconnection? Was there a sense that people, this concept of art for art's sake was not satisfying anymore? What is getting artists, and maybe we'll, you know, if others of you also want to comment on this, but what is driving this?
Yeah. You know, I really believe that it's not a new conversation. I believe it's returning. You know, I think, you know, there's a lot of sort of like rethinking, reenacting, you know, an engaged participatory, people call it social practice, social engaged work. You know, I think a lot of artists are feeling like they want to blur the lines of their art practice with other disciplines, sort of what some people are calling a non-disciplinary type of practice, where cultural production, where art practice becomes cultural production. You know, I also think, you know, artistic trends come and go, and, you know, my job is to try to understand what artists are doing. And Southern Exposure, you know, we're new to the public art world. We always had supported artists to work in site-specific ways, but about 6 years ago, it started to feel like so many artists were going out onto their own and trying to do this type of work that we just decided it was time for us to start really supporting it. And at first, you know, it was a harder idea for people to swallow, but now actually that we've been doing this for about 6 years and we've commissioned many projects, I feel like there's a really healthy national dialogue. There are some organizations around the country which are real leaders in the conversation. The Bay Area doesn't have like one necessarily leader. I would say there's a real symphony of different perspectives, but you know, people get into the idea of making, and back to the idea that you know, like I said, an art audience oftentimes can be limiting.
What does that mean?
Well, you know, I think if you want to go look at art, you have to be inclined to maybe walk inside of a space. Southern Exposure is free. So, you know, but let's say a museum or a more traditional type space, you know, you have to spend $15, $20. You have to have the intention to experience art. If you encounter a public art project as you're walking down the street, it's a really different experience. You know, Southern Exposure commissioned a project just back in June called The Cries of San Francisco by an Oakland-based artist, Allison Smith. It was a very participatory project involving 70 artists. We took over sites in downtown San Francisco for one day, sort of asking the idea of is what do artists have to cry out about? And so each of them took on a peddler identity, and they all had a quote-unquote ware to sell. In many cases, it was offering up more of an exchange or an exchange with the public, but, you know, thousands of people were able to experience these many participatory, engaged conversations and performances and literally cries, artists crying out, like in the tradition of street peddlers of the past. And for us, you know, to have an audience that, yes, there are art audiences coming out to see this, but there's also tourists and people who would never encounter art otherwise to be able to participate in the project, it definitely, it's quite different. It's also much more complicated. It's more expensive, logistically speaking, as a cultural producer of sorts. You know, I think there's a reason why it's more challenging to work that way.
Mm. Jackie or Susan, anything to add about this, the concept of what's driving artists, and also this other point that you're starting to make here, Courtney, of how do you put art in people's everyday lives or put it in their path so they kind of have to kind of come upon it. They don't have to make an excursion.
Yeah, I think Courtney's point was well taken about the idea of these being practices that you return to in a way. I mean, certainly artists are publicizing themselves and publicizing their practice by being in the streets, showing their art, doing something that is artistic. In the 1960s, there was an artist named Daniel Buren in France who literally had people wear painted signboards that looked like paintings themselves. So he was criticizing the idea that art was only inside museums, only inside galleries, and saying, well, actually, a signboard looks much like the rectangular or the square or the quadrilateral form of the signboard. And so here we're doing something that's equally commercial. We're selling the idea of the painting. So when I hear about this practice about artists crying in the streets, I also hear a sort of critique there that's underlying it about where is art found? How do people engage with it? Who are the people that engage with it? And they're doing something that's very individual in what we call the DIY kind of moment too, as well in our current cultural place in Western art in North America and Europe. That is to say, make art that's not just about canvas or oils or about marble, but something that's it seems almost hand and emotionally and individually made, that's engaging to people in a very arresting way.
And Susan, when you hear descriptions like this, what comes to mind of how do you imagine that the public is perceiving coming upon, whether it's a one day crying out of artists or a monument that you commission? Do people get it that they're kind of experiencing art all the time when it's not located in the traditional places?
Oh, I think so. It's certainly in a city like San Francisco where we have so many opportunities. We know that it's something that communities demand. Interestingly enough, Park and Rec did a recent survey of the things people wanted in their parks, and right behind clean restrooms was more public art. Yeah. So, actually, the Department of Public Health one of their indicators of how healthy a community is how much public art they have, how much access to art. So I think that you're asking about what drives artists, and I think it's a mutual desires on the part of communities to have cultural objects, artistic experiences in their communities as a means of providing meeting, context, placemaking, and on the part of artists, at least from what they tell me in their letters of interest, and these projects are hard, so there are easier ways to make a living, believe me. Artists' real desire to be really be part of a community, to really engage in a project that does something really nice for people. Mm. I mean, there's a lot of more philosophical ways to put it, but sometimes I think it's as simple as that.
Mm. That people are just wanting to connect in a way that they haven't before. And so as we think about this some more, I'd like to hear from you. You've already mentioned some pieces that help to symbolize what we're talking about tonight. But I wanted to hear maybe another round of descriptors of specific projects that you've worked on or seen recently that really start to capture how the wheel is turning again to try to draw the public in. So why don't we start with you, Courtney?
Sure. I mean, that's primarily how we work. And, you know, in one given year, we commissioned like 8 projects. So, you know, I'll just maybe cite one example from the past, and actually a project that we're working on that's going to be presented later this year. We worked with this really emerging level collective of artists called Neighborhood Public Radio. And I bring it up because, you know, it's radio. They really wanted to create an alternative voice for the community through their own radio station. We were one of the first organizations to commission them to work with us in an exhibition in 2004 where they set up shop and took over, and it was the most amazing experience because hundreds of people over the course of 6 weeks came in to work with them. Later on, we commissioned them to create a radio station in our small storefront. We were a nomadic arts organization for several years, and that's when they really started bringing the radio beyond the space of the actual station and doing mobile radio tours, site-specific projects dealing with cartography and mapping and neighborhood stories. And, you know, thousands of people really participated in this project, and they've since gone on to be commissioned by the Whitney Museum of Contemporary Art in LA. They're really fantastic. And another project we're working on right now, we actually started a public art award. It's called the Grau Award. It's part of our SOEX offsite public art series where we're able to commission a larger project. And Jenny Chapman and Mark Riegelman were our first winners of that award. And they're doing a project called Manifest Destiny, which sort of plays with the idea of bringing sort of the westward movement to, you know, put your stake in the ground and establish territory. But they're doing it in the midst of downtown built up San Francisco, and they're inserting a log cabin in a very, very unexpected place. Typically, we don't do sited works. We only work in temporary formats. But I think, you know, there's so many amazing ideas behind what they're doing. And, you know, to try to, you know, play out the idea, what does it mean to establish a new territory? And what is the idea of manifest destiny in terms of how do you look at that now based on the historic idea of manifest destiny, which is, you know, a very problematic term. And we're interested in looking at it critically. You know, it's very challenging as a small independent art space to secure permissions. We're working with the planning department, the billing department, the historic preservation department, and Jenny and Mark are extremely talented artists, so they're making it easy for us. But, you know, that's another part of the dialogue I'd like to get to, which is, you know, what is the public art landscape of the Bay Area? What really is going on? And you know, how does a place like the Arts Commission versus Southern Exposure and all the other, you know, groups that are weighing in to the dialogue, what does it really look like here? What is the public art terrain?
Mm. Well, that's a perfect lead into you, Susan. what is the Art Commission? What kind of pieces are you commissioning? What's your vision for what public art is? And what are kind of the constraints you're operating under?
Yeah. Well, of course, my vision of public art is a very Catholic one, and it incorporates almost anything. But since our program, at least the public art program, is funded by capital improvement projects, which is when the city builds something, we work from everything from the airport to the zoo, and that's what generates our funds. So we deal pretty strictly with the built environment and our work, because of the funding source is limited to things that are usually part of the architecture. Not always, but for the most part. So that's kind of a restriction that we work with most of our projects. We do have other funding, but a much smaller amount that is able to go to more temporal pieces that have a more of a short-term duration or more interactive duration.
Was it the Buddha head that was at Civic Center?
That was a temporary installation, or some of the light installations we did on Market Street. We've done performance pieces we've done on Market Street. Those are have another source of funding, but 99% of our funding is generated from the construction costs of, you know, the airport or new public safety building or new general hospital.
Mm. And so how do you see your organization in contrast to organizations like Courtney's?
Oh, where I see us in total a symbiotic relationship, because artists frequently get the experience that they need by working through a nonprofit organization first and a temporary project first. It because the whole notion of working in the public realm is different than working in the studio. So the artists start to get their first, you know, sort of learn the vocabulary, maybe get the bug, get that experience that it's kind of critical for them to be able to then to make the next step to doing maybe more permanent work with a commission for a public building.
And you said something about the vocabulary or what it takes to do something in a studio versus something for the public space. Again, just to kind of help draw out those distinctions, what do you mean by that?
Well, there's the whole social and political context. In other words, it isn't just what you want to do. You have to, even for a temporary piece through Southern Exposure, you have to get permission to use the site. You got to get permits. If you're going to have some sort of built element out in the public realm, it's got to meet ADA code. It's got to, and it's not what you think is ADA, it's what is defined. It might have engineering requirements. All of these things suddenly come into play that are not necessarily there in a studio. And then that whole process of what does it mean to engage in a public space and how that's different from a gallery or a museum context.
So Jackie, Francis, back to you. I wondered what you think of this notion that, you know, public art can allow artists to reach out, engage a public, try new things out, be experimental, and yet there's some of these constraints that they have to operate under. So in certain ways, being in the gallery, it's sort of you and your form that you're working with as an artist. And then once you're going, and perhaps that seems limitless, right? That seems unencumbered. And then the public realm seems to come with some constraints around it, but then it also seems to have some ways in which people can expand. I'm curious your thoughts about that kind of dichotomy there.
Yeah, I mean, when you asked us to think about examples, I started jotting down things, and it just made me think of something like the MAP project in the Mission, as something that I patronize.
What's that stand for?
Mission Arts of, tell me, Susan and Courtney, what is that acronym?
It's MAPP.
Right, and it starts for
Mission Arts
Public Programs. I'm sorry, I should know that, but I don't.
Maybe we can get someone to look that up for us.
This is a monthly activity that happens starting Saturday afternoons and goes into late Saturday night. So it's family friendly as well as for adults as well. And it involves activities that range from ball dancing, tango dancing in someone's yard in a residence in the Mission, to performances of artists in bakeries and cafes, to the conventional art opening. But it's not just looking at art that's on the wall. It might be people sharing recipes, people sharing seeds from their own garden, etc. So this idea of culture and the cultural really expands multifold. And it seems to me that it doesn't have the same sort of restrictions necessarily. I mean, certainly these places have to be accessible, they have to be safe, etc., but it expands beyond what can go on in a certain kind of government building, because the whole space becomes display space. 10 or more blocks of the Mission neighborhood become museum-like, gallery-like, culturally activated.
And the word that's coming into mind right now is democratization, right? The space is the boundaries are exploded, so the accessibility is widened, but also in the way that people participate, that the art, because it's experiential, that in fact the public is very key in creating the art, so that kind of really sort of weaves things together.
Absolutely, and I think what it is exactly what some of the artists who are activating the space as a social space, as a cultural space, want. They don't want a passive relationship with an audience. They want an interactive relationship with an audience. They want an audience that's somehow bringing something to the artistic project, whatever it may be like, that says that you are helping to create the space. It's not just me, the artist, making something that's plopped down in front of you.
And we have confirmation that it's the Mission Arts Performance Project.
Thank you.
This is 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache. And tonight, we're talking about the changing concept of public art with our guests, Courtney Fink, Executive Director of Southern Exposure, Jackie Francis, art historian and senior lecturer in the Program in Visual and Critical Studies and the Department of Painting and Drawing at the California College of the Arts, and co-editor of an anthology about Romare Bearden. I got it right. Entitled Romare Bearden, American Modernist. Perhaps we should, I think there's a link there to public art. We should talk a little bit more about him. And Susan Pontius, Program Director of the Civic Art Collection and Public Art Program with the San Francisco Arts Commission. 415-841-4134 is the number to dial to join our conversation. Again, that's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. So let's stick with Romare Bearden for a moment, because he actually made a piece of public art that resides here in the Bay Area.
That's right. So this is a mural, Berkeley and Its People, that is in the City Hall chambers in Berkeley. And Bearden was not a Bay Area artist, neither by birth nor by extended experience. He was a New York artist. But he was commissioned in the 1970s to make a mural. And that mural is what murals have done all the time, which is somehow reference local history, local personages, local landscapes. So there are things like the Cal Berkeley Campanile there. There's a panoramic sea of the bay with Treasure Island. There's the Bay Bridge, etc. So this is something that the city of Berkeley wanted to represent itself, not only in terms of the government, but also in terms of that community in its best and most beautiful sense. And so this is a little bit of public art that's both traditional in that it's a mural, but it's also not a standoffish art. It somehow tries to democratize the form that is represented there in terms of the figures, the people, the demographic of Berkeley.
Hmm. And as you were talking about this democratization, it made me wonder, well, what are we asking of the public as artists are reaching out to them? I'm wondering, you know, if people were not just kind of happening upon art or going out on the town in the Mission for an evening to kind of see what's happening, if they kind of had a feel that they were sort of integral into the making of the art, what would the public feel about that as a somehow a burden or somehow some sort of mantle that's being placed upon them? I'm curious, any thoughts from any surveys that either the Arts Commission or Southern Exposure has done about what the public, I think the public wants more public art, you said, but how do they see themselves in terms of the this engagement process? Do they see themselves as ready, willing, and able? Courtney?
I mean, I think they do. This is a sophisticated, open-minded city for the most part. And, you know, there's many layers of a public art conversation, you know, anywhere from, you know, there's a really long and deep mural history here. There's the civic art program. There's a very strong presence of the Burning Man aesthetic and sort of that history and tradition around the city. And then you've got sort of this really strong green, urban greening, landscape, and that, you know, and then of course there's the more independent interventionist DIY projects. And so if you look at all of those together, there's a lot going on the street. And I think, you know, people come here for that when they visit. People can choose to ignore it, which is something, as someone who's on the street a lot with artists, I can tell you that people don't always look or participate, but people who are willing and open-minded will, and I think are always surprised. So I've had a really positive experience. Oftentimes we've had people who are not interested, don't like what we're doing, but frankly, I feel like that's a sign of success, because if you're challenging what people think about art, that is actually one of our jobs. We're trying to push the boundaries. We're trying to push the conversation forward. And sometimes, you know, sometimes I feel like there's a lack of criticality and a lack of critical debate. And I very much appreciate when there is sort of a critical conversation that comes up. And if anything, sometimes participatory art requires too much of a commitment. I think that's a big criticism of a lot of the public art that's being made now is, oh, I have to take off my shoes and I have to do this and I don't want to. Well, then don't do it, you know.
And Susan, what do you think about this idea? Are we asking too much of the public?
Well, I do think we underestimate sometimes what it takes to catch people's attention. I sort of think, and you know, I work a lot at the airport, and I have kind of a grab 'em by the throat theory of public art in those kinds of very busy contexts where people are very intent on getting where they're going. They're busy. It takes a lot to kind of get them to notice.
Slow them down.
Slow them down enough to notice that there actually is art there and that they might be interested in looking at it. We're competing against a lot of other activity, advertising and all of that. So I think sometimes we tend to be naive about what we could really what it really takes to get to get the attention of the casual viewer, as it were.
And Jackie, I want to follow up on something that Courtney said about sort of how successful is public art when, you know, if people are engaging it or ignoring it, or what are they doing? You know, do they gladly take their shoes off? You know, do you have to coax them to take their shoes off?
Yeah.
How do we measure the success of public art? And maybe to kind of juxtapose it, you know, museums may gauge their success by the number of memberships and the number of visitors they have, and galleries by the number of pieces they sell. How do we gauge in this kind of outcomes-oriented society, how do we engage that public art has done its job?
Oh, I think it's exactly as both Susan and Courtney have suggested. It's when there's conversation generated. And we talked very briefly, Joseph, about a 19th century example, and I won't say a thousand things about it, but just in brief, there was a 19th century commission for a portrait statue of George Washington that was made by a sculptor named Horatio Greenough. Greenough, having been acquainted with certain kinds of European practices of portraiture, decided to depict George Washington as a Roman senator. So he was bare-chested and in a toga. The U.S. Congress went ballistic. You know, this is not the way they expected the founding father of the United States to be depicted. And yet, this is something that you teach in art history classes, to talk about the kinds of conversations that art can provoke. And certainly, it's a piece that still survives. We didn't destroy it. It shows us about where we were in the 19th century. It shows us what Greenough's training told him to do, and it showed us about a disconnect. And it's a really, you know, brilliant textured example of the kinds of discourse that we want. And we want that kind of thing. We want people to think about, well, why am I taking off my shoes? Or what am I supposed to do in the dark in a room, in a space that's a tent? Mm. Maybe there's something that I'm supposed to think about that's not visual. Maybe it's some sort of other sense that should be activated.
Mm. And Courtney, back to you for a second. You mentioned that, you know, we live in a city that's particularly sort of open and engaging and educated around art. Do you feel like that is who public art is going for? Isn't that the typical art goer that would have gone to museum anyway? Or are we trying to reach out to the art engager that would never think of themselves as such?
I think it really depends on the artist's intention, in the case for me, because we're really driven by the artist's ideas. We're not responding to like a civic location or, and so, you know, I personally feel like, believe it or not, despite all the stuff going on, that there's not nearly enough of it. I actually think San Francisco is fairly conservative when it comes to public art. It's actually hard, as one of the few independent nonprofits trying to produce, very much in a symbiotic relationship, as Susan said, with the Arts Commission, but it's challenging, I think, to get the funding we need. It's challenging to do something independent and or something new, something kind of experimental. But I personally feel like when you've got social networks and you have media and you have so many ways that public art truly exists in the world, that if you really think about it, a lot of public art is experienced by people through another form of information at this point. You didn't see it, but you read about it online, or you heard about it from a friend, or I feel like, you know, a lot of artists maybe work towards the media or understand, if they're sophisticated, that their work is going to be experienced far more online than it ever would have in person. And so I feel like these are things that are in my mind right now.
Susan, I saw you nodding your head. Did you want to add something to that?
Oh, I think that I just wanted to sort of agree with Courtney that I think San Francisco tends to be more conservative in the visual arts than we would might otherwise think. Certainly in the built environment, sometimes I think we think of San Francisco as kind of I call it the Victorian theme park, both in architecture and in art, that actually kind of getting in some cases moving beyond that period and that sort of orientation is challenging.
And why is that?
I just think it's how people tend to think of San Francisco, think of their neighborhood, think about what they really, you know, historically have been attached to, even though that is, you know, changing every day. It can't help but change. And I see no problem with the contemporary existing next to the historical. I think the two enrich each other, but not everybody thinks that way.
Jackie?
Yeah, I mean, I gravitate toward controversial art projects, but I was thinking about the Oldenburg and Van Brogen project down on the Embarcadero, the Cupid Span, and I was looking at some things on the internet where some people were responding very negatively to this sculpture. They felt that it had failed in some way. I mean, it's a very typical sculptural project in terms of its wry humor, the idea that the heart is left in San Francisco, but you can't see it. And so underneath the ground, you're supposed to imagine the heart, which is not visible. And there are some people that would look at that and say, that's a failed project. But I said, no, I would say no. It's created some ire, which is great. You know, no one can just walk by and not think about it. And so these kinds of things aren't necessarily measured in a survey, but maybe in the age of the internet and Twitter, they're measured through social media. Someone would put up a site and say, oh, well, this is a, quote, failed art piece.
And then, you know, somehow you've gotten people's attention, and that's a measure of success in and of itself. So in the last few minutes of the program, I wanted to expand on something you talked about earlier, Courtney, which is the landscape here in San Francisco, and how do we make it more fertile? How do we explode it even more than it is? What do you see are other barriers or other things that we need to be pushing against?
Well, you know, there's no lack of artists with amazing ideas and who are ambitious and want to do things. So I don't think that's the problem. If you could only see just the amount of brilliance coming through our doors and proposals. I really believe that, you know, like I said before, it is more challenging to navigate producing public works, and I don't think a lot of organizations here are dedicated to doing that. I also don't think that there's a lot of funding opportunities for small organizations to get to do that. You know, I think hopefully Southern Exposure is converting supporters of the arts by producing really compelling projects that they're important to fund. And I believe that, you know, the true beauty of our city is that artists just take matters into their own hands and do what they're going to do. And that, to me, is one of the things that I love about the Bay Area, is that it's truly an artist-centered city. The nonprofit art community is very vital here. If they don't get a grant from us or they don't get a commission from us, they are just going to go figure out how to do it on their own. And I think that's a real defining element of the Bay Area, sort of an artist-driven culture. I think if more organizations were willing to take a risk and follow that, you know, I also, you know, it's a matter of resources. This is a very economically challenging times. Organizations have had to scale back. They're just trying to meet their core mission and realize their programs. And, you know, I can't really explain why there aren't more groups trying to produce independent public art. There's actually a newer group called Foresight, started by Cheryl Haynes, who has a commercial gallery downtown, and they've started doing public art projects in the Presidio, and a lot of works based on sort of the history and, of land art and cited works in the Presidio. So I think it's starting to happen.
Mm. And so, Susan, as a representative of the Arts Commission, what is the Arts Commission doing or trying to do to kind of bring in some more funding for public art?
Well, one of the things we're doing right now is working to amend the planning code that will, right now, developers within the area that's called the downtown plan have a public art requirement where they are required to put some kind of a sculpture or painting or whatever on their property. What we're doing is amending that so that the developer has the option of putting the money instead into a public art trust that's managed by the Arts Commission. Some of those funds will go to grants to nonprofit organizations to do public art in the downtown area. It'll allow us to do projects in that area, and it also will provide funding to maintain said projects in this area. So we don't know yet how much this change will generate, but it's one of the most exciting things to come along in a long time. So we hope it passes the Board of Supervisors, and we think it will. It's being supported by the mayor and President David Chu.
Will it have to go before the voters?
No.
Okay.
Support of supervisors.
And Jackie, this idea of Susan's earlier on of how the amount of the quality, perhaps, of public art is kind of a measure of the health of a community and a health of a society. How far do you think that concept is going to go? And how do you think we can get to a point, perhaps one day, where public art is seen as just as vital in trying economic times such as this one?
I was just jotting down some notes about that. I mean, it's a very sellable idea. It's the sort of thing, not just in terms of making a city a destination city, for instance, like some place like Bilbao in Spain, which has become a destination city. It was a dead industrial town in Spain, but it was revived by the Frank Gehry design for the Guggenheim Museum there. And we not only need to think about buildings and statues, et cetera, but we could even be a destination city for performance art. We could be a destination city for spoken word, et cetera. So things that could happen in spaces designated or not, whether it's Union Square or somebody doing a moving performance piece down Market Street or through a neighborhood like the Bayview or through public spaces, residential, commercial, etc. And so these are the sorts of things that people can see that there's a dollar amount attached to, if I can speak so vulgarly. Tourists will come.
Do.
Oh, please do. Sure. That people will see that. People will see that tourists will want to be part of it, and certainly citizens will want to take a measure of it as Bay Area or San Francisco Pride, etc.
So it sounds like we went from this conversation of art for art's sake to art in service of, and then sort of fill in the blank. and that's perhaps where public art is poised at this point, to figure out how it fits in to new structures and how it fits into evolving experiences and how it fits into engaging long-time art engagers, but engaging the public in general. And that's, I think, a great place to stop our conversation. That's City Visions for this evening. I want to thank our guests, Courtney Fink, Executive Director of Southern Exposure, Jacqueline Francis of the California College of the Arts, and Susan Pontius of the San Francisco Arts Commission. Thank you all for joining me this evening.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks.
For a link to this show, to tell us what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, check out our website at cityvisionsradio.com. Our engineer this evening was Eric Wayne. I produced tonight's program, and we had in-studio help from Shireen LeClaire. City Vision's senior producer is Judith Sansone, and Neil Freese manages our website. Join my co-host, Lauren Meltzer, next Monday. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night, and have a great week.